Hello, everyone. Welcome back once again to another episode of Mind Shift. This is the podcast that is here to assist you along your journey of deconstruction and discovery, this thing we call the spiritual life, and especially for those of you that have perhaps walked away from organized religion, the church, the mainstream institutional evangelical fundamentalist church. I am your host. I am Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you again for joining me for today's episode, which is a very challenging and thought-provoking conversation that I recently had with David Madison. I brought you the first half last week, and if you haven't had a chance to listen to that episode yet, I would encourage you to go back and catch part one of this conversation with David Madison, who is a minister turned atheist in the process of doing a PhD in biblical studies and going to seminary and everything else. Much like me, he had to question a lot of things about his faith and his belief system. And in the end, he ended up walking away not just from the church, but from God entirely. And he's written a book in 2016, which is entitled 10 Tough Problems in Christian Thought and Belief. A Minister Turned Atheist Shows Why You Should Ditch the Faith. And of course, we are referring to the Christian faith. Now, I feel like I need to put a disclaimer in here at this point before we come to the conversation between myself and David. I am not trying to talk you out of being a Christian. If you identify as a Christian, that's fine. I have no problem with that. I just want to help you to think critically. One of the statements that David made in last week's episode was that he was struck by the fact that as he was writing the book and interacting with people on his Facebook page that he made for the book, and ever since the book has come out, he's written a lot of articles on the Debunking Christianity website. And of course, Christians just are rabid when they come to defend what they see as attacks against their Christian faith. But one of the things David said was that he was struck by the total lack of curiosity among so many Christians. And the idea that, what do you mean there are problems within Christianity? They've all been solved, surely, haven't they? Theologians, biblical scholars, preachers, there are no problems. What do you mean there are problems within Christianity? And this is something that we're going to look at today. Specifically, we're going to get into this issue of the problem of evil. And that is one of the major issues. It always has been, both within Christianity historically, as well as going back even to Judaism, which of course is the religion from which Christianity came. Let's take a minute to think about this problem of evil. Is it something that's only been recently formulated? No. If we look at the history of the problem of evil, it goes all the way back to ancient Greece. There's been a sort of classical formulation of this issue of the problem of evil all the way back with the Greek philosopher Epicurus. And it's quite interesting to look at Epicurus's argument. He basically said, first of all, sort of this logical syllogism, he said, first of all, if an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, that is, all good, all loving God exists, then evil must not exist. And I think the implication that Epicurus was raising was that why would a good, all-powerful, all-loving, benevolent God want his creation to suffer with this issue of evil? But of course, we all know that evil does exist. So therefore, Epicurus concluded that an omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, that is, all-loving, all-good God must not exist. And thus, over the centuries, both within Judaism and in Christianity, as I say, this has been a huge thorny issue, reconciling this conception of a good, loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God who sees everything. And this is something that David and I will talk about in this episode. If he even is concerned about the numbers of hairs on our head, the number of sparrows who fall from the tree, it's almost like a micromanaging God. Why doesn't he, or why can't he, do something about huge problems like evil, suffering, the Holocaust, children who are starving all over the world, child slavery, sex trafficking, and on and on and on it goes. The evil that is clearly present in the world. Why doesn't he do something? Why can't he do something? The conclusion may be then that God isn't all powerful, or he isn't all loving. Maybe he's a fiend. Maybe he's evil. And so Theologians and scholars, as I say, have been wrestling with this problem for centuries. It's probably the biggest issue within Christianity, and this is something that David and I are going to touch on in this episode. But before I get into the conversation between myself and David, I just want to mention real briefly a couple of things. I've got a lot of feedback this last week from the previous podcast, as well as the article that I wrote on Theology Corner, What Happens After People Leave the Church. And I've also put a link again in this week's show notes for that article, which describes a spectrum of 1 through 8. Where are you on the spectrum if you're a person who's left the church behind, and possibly as the scale goes down to numbers 6, 7, and 8, a person who has left God behind as well, or maybe you've become a deist. And this is something that David and I talk about as well in this episode a little bit. We'll touch on that. So we'll come back to that again at the end of the conversation. We said last week that I wanted to put David on the scale. We concluded that he was certainly a number 6. And if these numbers don't make any sense to you, you need to go back, listen to the episode from last week, or click on the link to my article on Theology Corner. And what I've heard from people is that it's a good sort of spectrum to describe where you're at in the spiritual journey, or especially, as I say, if you're a person who's walked away from the mainstream church, because what it does is it gives you the language, it gives you the words maybe to describe, yes, this is who I am right now, this is where I'm at right now, or I'm moving from point to point along the spectrum. So let me know which number you are. I've had a number of people contact me via email and Twitter and Facebook as well to say, yes, I'm a number whatever on the scale. So I'm very interested to find out where you're at on the spectrum if you identify at all with my scale. I'll just say real quickly before we start the conversation that I'll talk a little bit how you can get a hold of me on social media and email and Facebook platforms after the conversation with David. One of the things I'll remind you that we were talking about at the end of last week's episode, we had been talking about this issue of inspiration of the Bible, inerrancy of the Bible, and this is kind of where we pick up the end of that conversation in this episode, and then we'll get into more specifically some of the topics in his book, this issue of the problem of evil, as well as some of the other issues that he raises within his book. So let's go on into the conversation, part 2, with David Madison, a minister turned atheist. Is he going to convince you, that is, if you're a Christian, to ditch your Christian faith? So if you want to be challenged, then don't miss this conversation. Well, it's interesting. I read an article on this issue of inerrancy, and the author said most Christians are using a circular logic. In other words, they say that the Bible says that it's inspired, so that it must be inspired. It's a narrowly circular logic, but that doesn't seem to bother them at all. He said it doesn't perturb them at all, the fact that they're quoting the Bible to prove the Bible. And so what do we do? Where do we go from here?
Well, one of the parallels I use try to get people to see the stupidity of that argument is the small town I was raised in Indiana, there was a very sharp divide between Protestants and Catholics. And one of the things we liked to ridicule the Catholics about was the Virgin Mary, but also the infallibility of the Pope. We didn't understand exactly what that meant because it doesn't mean what Protestants at the time thought it meant. But you could say to Protestants, do you believe that the Pope is infallible? No, of course not. Well, the Catholic Church tells us that the Pope is infallible. Well, I don't believe the Catholic Church anyway, so why does that make any difference? Same thing. If you don't believe, to begin with, that the Bible is infallible, why would you believe it when the Bible says it's infallible?
Yeah, it's a circular logic.
Argument. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
But apparently it doesn't bother most Christians. It's an amazing thing.
Because they're thinking and it's sealed off. Yeah. They're not open to legitimate questions.
Yeah, there's a lack of critical thinking.
A young friend of mine many years ago who was raised Catholic, he said, well, if Christianity is so wrong, why do people believe in it? And I said, that's not a hard question to answer. They believe in it because it promises them they won't have to die. That's a pretty good product. That's a pretty good message.
Yeah.
And once you begin tampering with the truth of Christianity, then people have to face their own mortality.
All we're left with is what?
There's no way to get out of it.
That's why one of the reasons why the fundamentalists were so freaked out by the liberals back at the turn of the century, weren't they? What's left if you strip the scriptures of all of its core teachings and miracles and everything else? What are you left with? You're left with nothing. And maybe that's the whole point.
I have another Catholic friend years ago. She is desperately awaiting the time when she will see her mother again in heaven. She doesn't want anything to undermine that faith. That's the bottom line for her.
That's too emotionally threatening,
isn't
it?
The emotional investment in believing in Catholic dogma is extreme. Now, I believe that there are Christians on a scale. That's why when I'm told sometimes, well, nobody's going to read your book, no Christian's going to read your book, well, it's aimed largely for an atheist market to be another tool to use in the fight against Christianity.
Well, you're talking about the emotional investment people had in their faith, and then does your book represent a threat to that?
And that's the response that I get most from Christians. They just don't want to hear it. They just do not want to hear it.
Right. Stick the fingers in the ears and
they wonder,
that's it.
Exactly.
Well, now, on the subject of your book, I know you talk about 10 problems, and we said earlier we can't get through all 10, but I think looking at the chapter titles and you said in the beginning chapter, you have a couple of real high, maybe the first or second most critical ones. What stuck out to me was, number one, you say, is this problem of evil? And then another issue, I read an article that you wrote on debunking Christianity about the atonement, the central doctrine of the Christian faith. What would you say about the problem of evil and then this issue of the atonement? What would be your comments on those two doctrines?
One of the earlier iterations of my book, especially on the problem of evil, I had the title, The Easy Acceptance of the Very Terrible. And by that I meant, just look at human history. You can look at the Holocaust, you can look at the Black Plague, you can look at the pandemic of 1918 that killed 50 million people. You can look at all those things. These are horrible, horrible things. How in the world did God allow them to happen? And you can come up with all the lame excuses. Well, God was punishing us or God was testing us. They're all too lame. They don't make sense. Just contemplate, for example, the level of human misery because of mental illness. Is that a form of God punishing us? You come up with a horrible concept of God that way. But the problem of evil really is, and suffering, really is so difficult for a good God theology to get out of. My article next week is about, it'll be the fifth anniversary of the shooting of the students in Newtown, Connecticut. You know, 25, 6-year-olds were murdered in their classrooms. This was a gunman who used bullets that explode when they hit their targets. So those kids were ripped to pieces. Horrible, horrible crime. Couldn't God have done something? If I had unlimited powers, as God is supposed to, I know what I could have done to stop him. I could have given him a flat tire on the way to the school, a fender bender. His car ends up in the ditch. The police arrive, they find his weapons, and they take him off to jail. He doesn't go to the school. Hence, 20 kids are not massacred. I mean, I could have, you know, if I had unlimited powers, I could do that.
Yeah, there's plenty of ways he could have been
stopped.
Patterns. Yeah.
Christians are telling me that that God agitated the brains of biblical authors to write 1,000 pages of Bible. Couldn't God have done something to change the mind of the man who did that shooting? It doesn't make sense. It has to, in the end, it all has to make sense. And the problem of evil is simply not something you can overcome with excuses and excuses and excuses. I think at the time of the tsunami in, what was it, 2001, 2002, Southeastern Asia, 250,000 people drowned or crushed. And one cleric said, well, it's because the European tourists were going sunbathing on beaches in Thailand, topless.
Oh,
is that the kind of God you want?
So God was punishing them for their sin.
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty of nude beaches in Europe.
Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Maria. That's God's punishment for same-sex marriage.
Yeah, I've heard
that.
Does that
really make sense?
It makes sense in the context if you believe in this sort of America as a covenant nation and all the rest of it, where, yeah, God punishes us for our sins to try to get us back on track, much like the Old Testament recounts the covenant status of the nation of Israel, doesn't it? But that's how a lot of Christians see America.
Yeah.
We're a covenant nation, and God will bless us if we do the right thing, and if we stray from the path of righteousness, then he'll start sending natural disasters and other things to get our attention or to judge us or to punish us, and that's kind of the thinking, isn't it? So we deserve it, actually, in some strange way, according to that logic.
And then you end up with what I simply call bad theology.
Yeah.
You've adopted an evil God.
It's not even good
theology.
A God
would inflict that much suffering to prove a point or to punish same-sex marriage. If he wants to punish same-sex marriage, have the lightning strike the couples who've gotten married. End of story.
Every ceremony, bam, here comes a lightning bolt.
It would
send a pretty clear message that God is not in favor of same-sex marriages.
Yeah, but a hurricane to wipe out Houston, that message is a little bit blurry.
Yeah, surely there were a lot of righteous people in Houston that perished along with the people that were married, homosexuals and people who had abortions or whatever. The evil people, why did God wipe out so many indiscriminately? He's pretty sloppy work, I guess. Well, as you say, we know theologians have been arguing and discussing this problem of what's called theodicy, isn't it? That's the classical term, this defense of God, really. This idea that someone has to explain it. The classic formulation, isn't it? If there's a good God, then why does he allow evil? If it's an evil God, and all these other kind of formulations that Christians have been dealing with since the beginning of Christian theology, for sure, haven't they?
But the lack of Christian curiosity, it goes far beyond the Bible and the Gospels. Just the knowledge of Christian history, Christian origins.
Yeah.
They just don't understand. They don't get it. They don't want to. They know what they've been fed to believe since they were at their mama's knees and going to church every Sunday. How could my mother possibly be wrong? What she taught me about Jesus and the Virgin Mary or whatever. They don't want to hear it.
Or my priest or pastor. And then you get answers. I read in your book, someone said, of those children that were killed in that school shooting, well, I guess God just needed some more angels. And it's a very ghastly kind of a flip comment. It's meant to sound pious, I suppose. I heard that said of the recent shooting in Sutherland, Texas. Someone said that, and someone posted it on one of the groups I'm on in Facebook and said, you're not going to believe this. Someone actually said that these people, what better place to go than in a church praying? Statements like that. God somehow engineered the slaughter of these people because he needed a few more angels in his choir. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, there was a similar comment in 2012 following the Newtown shooting. A fellow said on Facebook that they got an early Christmas present because they're now with Jesus. I mean, talk about cruel and callous. You end up with a horrendous God.
Yeah,
and if you can't see that, then something terribly wrong with your thinking.
Yeah, and does the same logic apply to your point about the atonement, that you end up with a cruel God who's demanding a human sacrifice? You said that when Christianity ran into trouble was when monotheism embraced human sacrifice. That's the central doctrine of Christianity, though, isn't it? The atonement, the death of Christ on the cross, the resurrection, and all that. Why do you end up with this God who demands a human sacrifice?
Now, why is that even necessary? How can it possibly be defended as necessary? It doesn't make sense. Guy Harrison pointed out, he said, an all-powerful God, someone who sets all the rules, why couldn't he just forgive us rather than having to throw a human sacrifice into the scheme? It doesn't make sense.
It is the central doctrine, though, isn't it, of the Christian faith? You take that away, and there's really nothing left, because that's how Christians are going to get to heaven, is by getting that sort of golden ticket, like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and now they've got their golden ticket because they've said a certain set of preset belief systems, bullet points, or whatever you want to call them, and now you're on your way to heaven. And that's and I think a lot of people in churches have that. They're clutching what they think is the golden ticket, and they're done then. That's it. They've arrived, basically. They're just waiting to get there. So don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up, as the saying goes.
I've actually seen a graphic that shows a ticket with John 3:16 written on it. And as I pointed out in my book, John 3:16 is very bad theology. Whosoever believeth in him shall have everlasting life. But if you don't, hey, you're out of luck. And the same thing in Romans chapter 10, where Paul talks about if you say with your lips and if you believe in your heart that Christ was raised from the dead, you will be saved. It's magical thinking. It doesn't make any sense. It's theology run amok.
Yeah, and you can see then why the fundamentalists were so keen to sort of boil down the kind of five or six key things that you had to believe and confess and affirm to be a Christian. You had to believe in the virgin birth and the atonement and the fact that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Somehow that was in there too. Of course, they were trying to defend the scriptures, weren't they, against the liberals. So they had to chuck that in there. If they could actually say, if you don't believe that Moses wrote the Pentateuch, you're not even a Christian. Can you imagine making that statement? You're not a Christian if you don't believe that Moses wrote the Pentateuch.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. What sort of advice would you give? Let's say you're some Christian that's been in a church for a long time. He or she's grown up in a church. They've got questions, they've got doubts, but they don't feel the freedom to voice those concerns or fears. What would your advice be to a person who's sitting in that typical church setting, like maybe you and I came out of? What can that person do to kind of go down this path of sort of deconstruction?
In my book, I mentioned we need a different protocol at church on Sunday morning. Historically, people have left the church on Sunday morning after hearing the sermon, shaking hands with the pastor. I say tongue-in-cheek, they should shake hands with the pastor on the way in. And the pastor should say, don't believe everything I say because I'm a paid propagandist. And secondly, we've installed Wi-Fi in the church so that while I'm preaching, you can go onto Google and check out every claim I make. So my advice is get on the internet. If you have questions, get on the internet, check it out. So much information is out there now. Actually, I have on my website, the website for the book is www.10toughproblems.com. And on there, there's what I call the Cure for Christianity Library. There are more than 200 books that have been written since the turn of the millennium, since 2000. Check out the list of books that have been written on the falsification of Christianity. Mine is there, of course. You know, and not just the famous books by Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris. Those are the standards that people tend to go to. Yeah, those are good. But there are dozens, dozens, dozens of other books written by people who deconstruct the Bible, who show its problem, who show why it should not be taken literally, seriously, at all. But you got to do a voracious amount of reading on this. You really do. You really have to be a student. And if you're not used to that, well, if you want to find out what's really happening with your particular faith, check it out.
Yeah, you need to educate yourself, don't you? You can't just sit in the pew and listen to that paid propagandist every Sunday and accept his or her words as, I hate to say it, the gospel truth. No pun intended. Yeah, you have to be critically thinking. It's funny because I was going to say I did my degree on preaching and biblical studies, and I used to argue that we need to preach from the Bible and things like this, but now I've completely reconceived my idea of what preaching could be. And I think it's more in line with what you articulated. If I was ever asked to preach again, and by the way, I'm not getting any invitations to to preach anywhere. That's why I'm doing this podcast. But I would think let's deconstruct this text. Let's look at how it's been interpreted. This is something Hector Avalos was talking about on our podcast. He said the way he teaches the Bible now is he looks at how it's been interpreted over the centuries. And they talk about why are there such widely divergent interpretations of these of the same passages of Scripture, and it gets a phenomenal discussion going around that passage or topic or text or whatever, and the students come away with sort of this enlarged perspective, and they've maybe deconstructed some of their own presuppositions. So if you could do that in a sermon, I don't know if anyone would pay me to do that, but I'd be more than happy to do something along those lines of getting people to think critically instead of just accepting my word for it.
In the third chapter of my book, I list five flaws in the concept that the Bible is the Word of God, and one of those is the fact that you pick out any verse in the Bible and you will find a lot of different interpretations. Well, whose one is the right one? Who do you believe?
Well, according to John MacArthur, you believe him, I guess. He's got the correct hermeneutic, so, and he'll tell you so. The rest are all heretics, and it's just unbelievable. Yeah, it's whoever can shout the loudest or whoever can put the other group down, I don't know. Well, now, this is an interesting thing, something I was thinking about. Going back, I know we're wanting to wrap this up, but I had another thought that struck me On this subject of God, as you say, if this God exists, he must be a cruel God or a capricious God. What's your kind of counter to that? Are you saying, oh, look, there is no God, so therefore, how do you explain these occurrences like tsunamis, hurricanes, fires, floods, and evil that people do? What is your kind of answer to those things?
Well, it's an answer that people don't want to hear. We live in an impersonal universe. The earth was not created for us. You know, we had the woman who said God must have wanted more angels. When there was a similar shooting in the UK, actually in Scotland, 1996, I believe, one person left a sign, a little note outside the school around the neck of a teddy bear. The note said, this was the morning that God overslept. So, did God want more angels? Did God oversleep? No, it's much simpler than that. There is no God who is overlooking the cosmos. Certainly there's not a God, a caring God, a micromanaging God who cares for humans and even sparrows, as Jesus said. You just got to get used to the reality of it. We are part of the cosmos that is unfolding. Everything in the cosmos dies. Everything. Whether you're talking about flowers, grass, planets, stars, they all die. That's just part of our fate of participating in the cosmos. Get used to it. Pick yourself up. Dust yourself off. Find meaning in your life through whatever it is you have to find meaning in friends, in literature, in music, in sports, whatever. Find your meaning in life. Make your life as meaningful as possible. Get on with it.
Yeah, so in other words, it is down to us at the end of the day. Natural disasters and human evil, it's bound to happen, isn't it? I mean, every time there's a mass shooting, I always say, well, there's going to be another one. And sure enough, we had the one in Texas, and then a couple of weeks later, there was one in California. We had the Las Vegas shooting. Why don't you just say, there are just evil people out there. It's not God's fault because, as you say, maybe God doesn't exist. Things just happen, and it's up to us to deal with it.
There are evil people. There are people with bad brains. Evolution gives some people bad brains, and you can't get around that fact. And Hurricane Harvey, well, from the perspective of the grand sweep of time, there have probably been 100 Hurricane Harveys sweep across the Houston area in the last 100,000 years. It's what nature does. God isn't punishing anybody. Nature isn't punishing anybody. It's a system. It's a storm system. It's energy. It sweeps across land masses, and it has been going on for millions of years.
And will continue to happen. Yeah, if a cold front meets a warm front, it's what happens, isn't it? Or it could be the result of human pollution or toxic emissions in the environment. I mean, there's a lot of things. I wonder, it strikes me that the deists back in the, 18th and 19th centuries, I wonder if this was kind of their way of sort of fudging. They're saying, well, we admit that there was a creator God, the cosmic clockmaker, created the universe, wound it up, set it in motion, and then walked away. And he's no longer a personal God overseeing every little sparrow that falls. That would explain a lot from the deist perspective, wouldn't it? That they can in a way, kind of have their cake and eat it too. They could say, yes, we believe in creation, but we don't believe that there's a personal God.
Christians sometimes go in that direction when they insist on the supremacy of free will. They take an extreme version of free will and just say, God doesn't interfere. God lets us do what we want to do.
Right,
and then you end up with horrendous events because God has to respect our free will. Well, I think that's crap.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah. If you believe that God is intimately involved in human affairs, cares about humans, cares about sparrows, even when someone says, oh, he has God-given talent, that means that God is working at the micro level. He's manipulating genes and DNA if he gives somebody talent. Well, then God has to take the blame for the 4,000 genetic diseases that there are. It's better just to say evolution can take the blame for that.
Yeah, you wonder if Christians are edging toward a sort of a deistic sort of God. But yet, I hear a lot of Christians claim things like when they find a good parking spot, well, God must love me. So he is so intimately concerned about my day among all the other things he's got to worry about, all the sparrows and the floods and the fires and everything else, that he got me a good parking spot when I needed to go to the mall. Is that the level that we're going to here now?
He let 2,000 children starve to death around the world. But he got me a parking place.
He got me a sweet parking spot. Yeah, so I actually had a good friend in the States when I was living there that every time we found a good parking spot, he'd say, well, I guess God loves us. He found us a good parking spot. Well, listen, we should probably wrap this up. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Okay.
You mentioned your website. What's a way that people can get a hold of you? Are you best, most active, like on Twitter or Facebook? What's the best way if people wanted to converse with you?
They can find me on Facebook, David Madison. The website, there's a way to send messages to me there. It's www.tenproblems.com.
And what's your Facebook or Twitter handle? What's your on Twitter?
David Madison, PhD.
Right. So you have to think about that for a minute now. Yeah.
So many handles, so many passwords.
This is it. The brain can't handle all the passwords, the accounts, and you can't have the same password for everything.
I have an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, but if someone gets the password to your Excel spreadsheet, you're screwed.
But on Amazon, it's very easy to find the book, David Madison, 10 Tough Problems, right there.
Yes, you can go on Amazon, find David's book, write a review. You can add your review to the growing list of what's already there. Well, listen, David, thank you so much for joining us on MindShift. This has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. I don't want it to end, but we need to wrap it up. So any last words of wisdom you want to lay on anyone before you sign off?
Just be curious. Ask questions. Don't take anybody's word for anything. Curiosity.
Including yours?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, thank you so much, David, for being on MindShift.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
So what do you think? Did David convince you, if you're a Christian, to ditch your faith? Should God be fired? This is the question. In David's book, he quotes from American journalist and satirist H.L. Mencken. And Mencken said, quote, "The whole Christian system, like every other similar system, goes to pieces upon the problem of evil," end quote. Do you think that's true? Does all Christianity fall apart on this issue of the problem of evil? Whatever your take on it is, it certainly is a thorny issue, isn't it? Does a good, loving, all-powerful God exist? And if he does, why doesn't he do something to stop the evil that's in our world and has historically been in our world? And it brings up a lot of other questions too, because here's a God that's described in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, as actually ordering genocide, the slaughter of men, women, and children by the nation of Israel as they came into the land of Canaan, which is today modern-day Israel. And it's a hard thing to reconcile that God of the Old Testament with this sort of loving, gracious God, the Jesus, the hippie guru that a lot of people have made him out to be in the New Testament. And as I said in the introduction, this whole problem of evil has been around for literally centuries. In fact, the scholar Marcion, way back in the 2nd century AD, he was struggling with this very same issue. And he read the Old Testament God as being rather belligerent and angry, and he rejected this God. He actually said there's two different gods. There's a God of the Old Testament, he's an angry, vicious God, and there's this loving God of the New Testament. And that was the way that Marcion reconciled these seemingly disparate views of God. And so you can see that someone like Marcion's wrestling with this problem of evil centuries ago. But of course, the church did not accept his view, and he ended up being excommunicated and branded a total heretic. So Marcion's solution never really worked. At least it didn't work for the church fathers. And I think it's important not to take this issue lightly, because if the story of Marcion and his lack of reception by the church gives us any indication, well, there's still a lot of pushback in the church today anytime you bring up this same problem of evil. But this is all part of deconstructing your faith, those inherited beliefs. When you deconstruct your faith, especially Christianity, things that you've been taught for years, especially if you've grown up in the church like I did. I was in the church from the day I was born all the way up through my adult years. I was in seminary. I was in ministry. I was an elder. I was a pastor. I have devoted a good chunk of my adult life either to academics, scholarship, and Christian circles, and in pastoring, teaching, leading other people in this thing called Christianity. But now I'm stepping back and going, wait a minute, what have I done? What have I been spending all my time doing? The good thing, I guess, is that it's given me the critical skills to think and analyze arguments. And that's why I'm doing this podcast. And it's funny now because I look back and think, okay, these are things that I'm stepping away from. These are things I'm walking away from. I'm shedding, I'm jettisoning a whole bunch of things that were a huge part of my life. In fact, virtually all of my life growing up, and as I say, into my adult years, I've been part of this thing called the church. And it's funny because the other day, Ray Guilford, who I did a couple of episodes with at the end of the year last year, we talked about biblical inerrancy and other topics, but he posted up the other day on our Mindshift podcast group, and I asked him if I could share these things that he put on the page. And he said, sure, that'd be great. So here's Ray's list. What Ray said was, things I threw out over the years, talking about his deconstruction process, until I realized there were nothing but crumbs left in the bottom of the bag. Here's some of the things on Ray's list. The nanny god, the helicopter god who oversees everything in your life with an insect intricacy, the Siri, Alexa god, the personal assistant who helps you find your car keys and saves you a parking spot close up, the big money Jesus of the prosperity gospel, or he says, the collateral damage Jesus of the genocide gospel. Another one is the divine healing issue. Another one is the second coming, the rapture, tribulation, millennialism. We don't need a divine ass wiping, says Ray. We have human problems. They were created by humans. They will be fixed by humans. Some more issues on his list that he gave up. Anti-intellectualism, demons, at least in every part of our lives. The purity cult or the purity culture, and that's a big one that I've been researching a lot lately. We're going to do some episodes on that as well coming up. Tithing, says Ray, suffocating, intrusive community, selling or sharing the gospel. A geocentric universe, the Bible, God the Potter, assurance, blessed or otherwise, and finally, inerrancy. And I had a few things that I added to my list as well, things that I'm kind of happy that I've given up. Young Earth creationism, and of course the ridiculous defense of young Earth creationism. The aggressive proselytizing of every non-Christian you encounter. Listening to sermons in church every Sunday, preached by people who are just really bad communicators. And of course, listening to bad exegesis in those sermons, listening to incredibly disagreeable statements made in those sermons as well. And if you've got anything to add to the list, let me know. If you've walked away from the church, what are some of the things that you're actually glad that you've left behind? And that's a sad statement. It really is a sad statement. So if this episode has been helpful to you, if Ray's list or my added on things have kind of triggered anything in you, things that you've walked away from the church and felt glad about leaving behind, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me, as I said before, a variety of ways. You can email me, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @MindShift2018. You can also find me on Instagram, @MindShiftPodcast. You can also stop by and like my MindShift Podcast Facebook page, which is found at facebook.com/MindShiftPodcast. And you can also drop by my website, preachersforum.com/blog, as well as my posts on the Theology Corner. And all these links are available in the show notes. And also, I will mention that if you have found the work of MindShift or the Preacher's Forum blog or my writings on Theology Corner helpful to you at all, you can help support the work of what I'm doing for as little as $1 a month. You can go to patreon.com/MindShiftPodcast and find out some more information about the rewards for being a Patreon supporter of this show. That would be great. And you can add yourself into the MindShift Podcast closed Facebook group. Okay, before I let you go for this week, I just want to mention what's coming up next Friday on MindShift. Well, it's a total change of direction, a total shift. We're going to bring you an interview that I did with Richard Jacobson, who is the author of the book Unchurching, Christianity Without Churchianity. And what we're going to hear from Richard is a completely different point of view than a person like David Madison. But as I've said before, that's what this podcast is all about. That is how you learn how to think critically, by being exposed to alternative frames of reference, alternative points of view that you may or may not agree with. So listen in next week. We're going to hear from Richard Jacobson. He's going to make the case that essentially the institutional church, the mainstream churches that we see, especially in America and North America, are doing it wrong in terms of how he reads the Bible. And so he's going to give us an alternative vision for what does church look like, or Christianity look like, without all the churchianity, all the trappings of churchianity. So be sure and come back next Friday for my conversation with Richard Jacobson. Once again, thank you for joining myself and David Madison as we talked about his book and some of the problems within Christianity. I hope that you have found this a stimulating and challenging conversation, and you'll come back next Friday right here on Mindshift.